Good morning. Please be seated. To the extent you can, of course. This is the next matter on for oral argument this morning is being heard by ITV. And it is Campbell versus Honor the Earth. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for a rebuttal. And the timing restrictions should be indicated on the screen. And if I could just have, the way the technology works is that unless you're speaking, your video doesn't appear to us. I see one counsel there. If we could have both counsel just say something separately into the microphone so we can make sure we're all connected. Thank you. We see you. Excellent. And you've just appeared on our screen, too. So we're all here. So, counsel, as you commence each leg of your argument, please state your name so that we can keep track of the audio recording of the proceedings. We don't record the video. So do please state your name. And counsel, for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Fred Bebo, and I represent Honor the Earth. This case is important because it involves a lot of confusion, I believe, about jurisdiction, both subject matter and personal, and it also involves some confusion, I think, with how the federal law, public law 280 works and what kind of jurisdictional rights have been granted to Minnesota. The district court order starts out by saying public law 280 does not apply, but then right after that says even if it did, that the Human Rights Act is criminal. And as we explained in the original brief, the Minnesota Human Rights Act goes a long way to explain that it's not a criminal law and that it's not meant to change anything about any of the criminal code that exists in Minnesota. So I'm not sure where that concept came from. And if you look through the district court order, you'll see that the Stone analysis was not fully and completely followed through. Two of the factors started some analysis, but not all four. And the court came to the conclusion it was criminal, but yet the matter is final as a civil matter in the state district court. So I don't understand how it could even be considered or determined criminal without either an attorney general or one of the county attorneys prosecuting. So it's been very difficult to look through the order. I would also add that when you look at Public Law 280, there is a provision that allows for tribal courts to make their own laws and be ruled by them. And that's what comes into play in this order. When you look through the complaint, virtually every person identified, except for the respondent in this incident matter, is a tribal member for mostly on-reservation conduct. When you look at the Minnesota Human Rights Determination, it says that there was no finding of probable cause, and it goes on to say it looks like most of the incidents occurred on-reservation.
Would you agree that Honor the Earth is a nonprofit incorporated in Minnesota under Minnesota state law?
I would agree that it's a 501c3 incorporated under federal law and registered with the state of Minnesota. It was registered in 1993, the same year that Minnesota developed the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Okay, but it wasn't incorporated under tribal law, correct?
You know, the tribal courts and laws really didn't exist until around 1997 when the Stone case came in with the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that's when jurisdiction started to be looked at a lot more. And so that analysis precedes the Stone court. And so that's why you don't see it there.
Go ahead. I was going to say, this entity did not have to be incorporated, did it? It could have just operated and functioned and not taken advantage of being a charitable, deductible, tax-exempt organization under federal tax law as well as Minnesota tax law and be a Minnesota nonprofit corporation. You can have a sole proprietorship and do environmental work and have employees and not be a corporate entity, right?
Certainly, but if you're relying on public donations and people are looking for the Sierra Club or, you know, National Wildlife Federation, or everybody operates. I mean, that's the whole concept here. So I look at this more from a federal standpoint, and it's like having Minnesota license plates on your car.
But, Council, given that Honor the Earth is not incorporated under tribal law, and Ms. Campbell is not an enrolled member of the tribe, how is Public Law 280 even applicable? Because it, based on the language of Public Law 280, it applies to litigation involving Indians as defined under the, as provided under the statute, and or members of enrolled members of a tribe. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding your argument as to how to Public Law 280 would even apply in this case, given that it's a resident of the state of Minnesota who's not Indian and a nonprofit that's not incorporated under tribal law. I don't see that there is any party who is an Indian or a tribal entity.
Certainly. And the first thing I would say is if you look at Public Law 280, you have to look at all of Public Law 280, not Section A, and just rely on that. You have to go to Section C. And Section C basically says that any custom or law or ordinance heretofore or hereafter that's not inconsistent with state law should be given the tribe discretion or the law to apply in this matter. And that's in 1953, before a lot of these other concepts were contemplated, because the federal government wasn't attempting to completely take over tribal functions. They understood that various tribal governments were at various statuses. Red Lake had its own court at the time. That's why when you look at the Stone decision, it talks about an expectation that the tribal courts continue to develop and broaden out in those various areas of subject matter jurisdiction. And when they do, like with the Stone decision, all of those traffic laws that were being applied on reservation, the state no longer has jurisdiction for. It's lost it essentially permanently unless Congress makes some other change to the law. And so that's what also happened with the Morgan decision when they looked at how the vehicle was. The vehicle was simply a tool.
But in the Morgan decision, it was the state was a party and seeking to enforce a state civil law. Here, the state isn't a party. And also in the Morgan decision, the car was owned by a tribal member. So there, Public Law 280 specifically applied because there was a tribal member involved and the state was seeking to enforce a state law.
Certainly, the actual people involved in the complaint are Indians on reservation, and the corporation is owned by Indians who were running it on white earth.
But don't we look to who the parties are, not who the founders of the nonprofit are?
You look to the parties for personal jurisdiction, and that's where I think the greatest confusion lies here. I agree that Minnesota can have personal jurisdiction under the Rubicon that you're describing, but I'm also saying under federal law that Minnesota has lost jurisdiction over this subject matter when the courts and the tribal government at White Earth set up the tribal courts in 1997, established their jurisdiction, and spelled out that when non-members come onto the reservation and engage in commercial and other kinds of activities with tribal entities, that they are putting themselves into the jurisdiction of White Earth.
And what language in the federal law are you referring to specifically?
The first part I was talking about Public Law 280C, and then the other part I'm talking about is...
When you say Public Law 280C, can you cite the language for me, please?
I just did. It's Section C. What it basically says, I mean, I can look for it in my brief if you're asking me to look for the written page, but what it basically says is any tribal customer ordinance heretofore or hereafter adopted by a tribe that's not inconsistent with the state law should be used for determining the outcome. And we have a law that says we have a court, we have jurisdiction, and that the person came into our jurisdiction and started engaging in commercial activities of employment, leasing, maybe having an apartment, all kinds of activities. That's the same way we look at minimum contacts for the state. That's for personal jurisdiction. subject matter jurisdiction here is simply workplace harassment tort allegations. And I'm saying that now the state does not have controlling subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, let me, if I could jump in for a moment, just so I can understand, maybe looking at the language specifically, just so I can understand what the basis is of your argument, your position for jurisdiction. The courts have jurisdiction over civil causes of action, and then there's two options, between Indians or to which Indians are parties. Which one of those two are you saying applies here?
What I'm saying is the language you're extracting is from the Bryan decision. And when you look at the Bryan decision, it's talking about several things at the same time. It's 1976. There are no other forums or courts available. And so under Public Law 280, the Supreme Court of the United States is explaining how and why Indians...
I believe I'm reading not from a case, but from Public Law 280. Which grants jurisdiction over civil causes of action between Indians or to which Indians are parties. So is it your position that that language is not as restrictive as it appears literally, that jurisdiction exists over causes of civil causes of action, one, between Indians, or two, to which Indians are parties? You're saying that that's not restrictive?
Concept language that was reinterpreted by the Bryan Court much in the same way you're reading it in 1976. You have to look at now, we're looking at where the reservations all have tribal courts.
So so I'm clear in the answer to the question, you're saying no, that this language is not restrictive. When it says that courts have jurisdiction over civil causes of action between Indians or to which Indians are parties, you're saying that that is not the limit of the court's jurisdiction.
Yes, I'm saying it's more limited now.
And what?
Federal action.
Okay, and what is the language in Public Law 280 that allows for an expansion beyond that plain language?
I'll look for the paragraph. I don't have it any better memorized than what I tried to share twice.
If you could refer us to which page of your brief you're looking at, that would be helpful as well, once you find it.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. And just for the court's information, I'm looking at page 11 for the comment that was just shared about the laws of private and private property and so forth that was asked, and it cites to Brian V. Itasca for that concept.
I don't know that he's. Maybe you can, during the break, when your opponent is arguing, you can look it up and point it out to us. We don't want you to have to use all of your time searching for things if you believe it's in your brief.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Bebo, what is your position on whether or not there's concurrent jurisdiction? Because it looks like you're pointing to paragraph C to say White Earth has a judicial system, they've adopted laws, et cetera. So are you saying that there's, what is your position on whether there's concurrent jurisdiction because this is a Minnesota nonprofit corporation, not Winona LaDuc personally, so not a tribal member personally? And then does it matter that there was off-reservation conduct? Does that impact? I know I'm asking a very complicated question, but this is a very interesting and complicated issue before the court. So is there concurrent jurisdiction then between the tribal court and government and the state courts under the Human Rights Act, because we're dealing with a Minnesota nonprofit? And then do we look to what's off-reservation conduct versus on-reservation conduct, and how should that impact our analysis in a minute and 23 seconds or less? No, you can have to your time.
Certainly. Now, I should have written that down a little bit myself, but it was a little bit.
It's a multi-part question, so I apologize.
That's okay. I would say that when you're trying to figure these pieces out, tribal members or the corporation always have a right to go to state court because we're also citizens of the state, and we may not prefer to go to tribal court. And so that's like, you know, getting your car license plates either on the reservation or through the state of Minnesota. And so these are personal choices about status. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say about the corporation part of this, certainly under normal circumstances, I would say yes, a corporation, without describing it, and a non-Indian person. But to me, those are personal jurisdiction concepts. The argument I'm making is subject matter. And so I'm saying that the subject matter of the case is workplace harassment allegations, and those are subject to the wider tribal court jurisdiction. I understand Minnesota has laws as well, but the grant of law that the state is using to access jurisdiction against tribal members is the same law that is limiting the state of Minnesota from now exercising jurisdiction because it's been brought to the attention of the state courts. I see my time is there.
You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use it, and we would like you to pinpoint that site for us if you can that supports your argument.
All right.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Christy Hall from Gender Justice, and we represent the plaintiff respondent, Margaret Campbell. Briefly, this is a sexual harassment case brought under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Ms. Campbell worked for several years as a defendant on the earth doing environmental justice work that she was very passionate about. But then she was sexually harassed by a coworker, and when she told her employer on the earth, the corporate entity, it dismissed her concerns and did nothing to fix the problem. Instead, on the earth retaliated against her by putting her on an unpaid leave, which caused her to quit, and then made sure that she never worked in the environmental movement again. So we are here today because of defendants' choices. But I want to start by focusing on one key choice, and that's the choice of defendant's founder, Winona LaDuke, chose to create the defendant, Honor the Earth, by incorporating as a nonprofit under Minnesota state law. And at the motion to dismiss stage, the allegations in the complaint must be taken as true. And so the specific allegation here is in paragraph 3 of the complaint. And it says, and I'm quoting from that, defendant is a nonprofit corporation under Minnesota statute 317A, registered with the state of Minnesota, end quote. And 317A is the chapter of Minnesota law that governs incorporation in the state as a nonprofit. Honor the Earth is literally a creation of Minnesota state law, and it is the defendant in this matter. There are no native parties in this case. And just like for-profit corporations, which can be headquartered anywhere and choose where to incorporate if they incorporate at all, you know, often incorporating in Delaware, for example, nonprofits can choose what laws to incorporate under or whether to incorporate at all. You know, you can draw an analogy to the context of federal court diversity jurisdiction. You know, for example, it's clear that in that context, Honor the Earth is considered a Minnesota citizen.
But
we acknowledge in our briefs, white earth courts do have concurrent jurisdiction over this matter. So going back to the diversity jurisdiction analogy, the corporation has two places of citizenship, its state of incorporation and its principal place of business. White Earth, the headquarters of Honor the Earth are on, or they're within the boundaries of White Earth. And several of the facts in this case occurred on tribal lands. And I agree, with appellants that almost all of the witnesses. In fact, it would not surprise me if everyone named in the complaint other than Ms. Campbell herself is an enrolled tribal member. So there is concurrent jurisdiction in that situation.
Well, in that case, does it make sense for the state to exercise jurisdiction?
Thank you, Judge Cochran. We do believe that it does, and for one very important reason, and that's that Ms. Campbell brought claims under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And the Minnesota Human Rights Act is very broadly written to protect the civil rights of everybody in the state of Minnesota and to eradicate discrimination. She has this state law, state statutory law, protects her right to a workplace free of sexual harassment and it prohibits retaliation against someone who raises the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace. Ms. Campbell is protected under that law. And the state
can I interrupt for just one quick section? So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, there's aiding and abetting liability. So presumably, your client could have added Michael Dahl or Winona LaDuc as defendants in the case. So how would that change our analysis? And what if all the conduct, the objectionable conduct, had in fact occurred on the reservation, and this nonprofit, their principal place of business, their registered place of business, is on the reservation? So what? How would that change things? Would the state court still have jurisdiction if you had the two tribal members as individual defendants in this lawsuit?
Yes, thank you, Judge Siebel. So in that case, Public Law 280 would be highly relevant. And Public Law 280 literally grants the state court's jurisdiction in that instance. Even in a case involving entirely conduct on tribal lands and both Native parties, in that instance, the language of Public Law 280 literally grants the state court jurisdiction. It's subject to exceptions, right? And there are some exceptions, and none of those exceptions apply here.
Because because it would be between two private party litigants rather than the state being a party to the case.
Absolutely, Judge Cochran, that is our position. Yes, it would be a different analysis if we have the Minnesota Attorney General, you know, as a party in the case on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, bringing these claims against a Native party. All right, then you would need to look to the question of whether the Minnesota Human Rights Act is civil regulatory or criminal prohibitory. And I believe it is criminal prohibitory, but we don't have that situation here. We have zero Native parties, and the state itself is not a party seeking to enforce state laws against tribal members.
So if the Minnesota Human Rights Act, if the district court was correct, and it is a criminal prohibitive statute, then what state regulations would not apply, or state laws would not then apply? I mean, there is no criminal sanction under the Human Rights Act. It, in fact, there's a provision in the Human Rights Act saying this has no impact at all on any crimes under chapter, you know, as set out in chapter 609. So then give me some examples of state regulatory laws that would not then be applicable. I mean, they're all criminal prohibitive in some fashion or another, correct? I mean, that if we're going to say the Human Rights Act is, then give me an example that is not.
Absolutely, Judge Siegel. So, you know, in that instance where we can look to established case law under the Stone-Cabezon analysis, for things that are considered civil regulatory, and there are a number of them. So, for example, in the Bryan case itself, that's a case about taxation, property tax, and that is absolutely civil regulatory. That's civil regulatory, and the state may not use Public Law 280 to get jurisdiction over Native parties under those laws. You know, and other examples from Minnesota case law directly from Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. So, for example, in the Stone case itself, there were a number of traffic laws that were found to be civil regulatory rather than criminal prohibitory. And so it's that criminal prohibitory, civil regulatory analysis from those cases, the Stone Cabazon analysis. And if you look at that analysis, the Minnesota Human Rights Act definitely falls on the criminal prohibitory side of the ledger. And of course, it's not a criminal law. But if it were so simple as to say, you know, you can just look at the caption, and if you've got a, you know, a CR in the case number, then you've got a criminal law, and you've got a CV, then you have a civil law, then there would be no need for the lengthy Cabazon-Stone analysis. But the Cabazon-Stone analysis, if I could just turn to that in my outline here. It includes a number of factors, right? And those factors are the extent to which the activity directly threatens physical harm to persons or properties or invades the rights of others. And obviously, civil rights are at stake under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The entire point of the law is to protect people's civil rights and protect people from being discriminated against. And then the second factor, the extent to which the law allows for exceptions and exceptions. And, you know, the question there is it a law that broadly prohibits conduct subject to some exceptions? And the Minnesota Human Rights Act absolutely is a law that broadly prohibits discrimination subject to some exceptions rather than a regulatory law like a tax law. And the third factor under the analysis is the blameworthiness of the actor. Certainly an entity that discriminates has violated a very significant public policy of the state of Minnesota. And then the fourth factor, the nature and severity of the potential penalties for a violation of the law. Well, no, you're not going to be putting a corporation in jail, but the nature and the severity of the potential penalties are significant. There are uncapped emotional distress damages available under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There are civil penalties that must be paid to the state. There are also punitive damages and attorney's fees available. And you can look at case law to find examples of million-dollar verdicts, which could bankrupt a company. So absolutely, the nature and severity of the potential penalties for a violation of the law, that factor is met too. So under the Stone-Cabazon analysis, and it's important to take a step back and think, we're in even if land, right? Even if the Minnesota Attorney General were representing the department as a party in this matter, and the defendant were a tribal entity, in that instance, then you would have to ask, is the Minnesota Human Rights Act criminal prohibitory or civil regulatory? And it is criminal prohibitory. The Attorney General absolutely can enforce the law against even tribal parties, unless there's another exception to Public Law 280. And Gavin discusses the other exception, which is tribal sovereignty. The defendant has expressly waived that argument. You know, it claimed in its brief that the issue of tribal sovereignty was a red herring. So, you know, again, there are lots of layers of this even if analysis. And you go all the way, you know, you peel the onion all the way to its core. And even then, the state court still has jurisdiction.
Can you briefly address appellant's argument that that Judge Ross's question that appellant was going to respond to? Can you briefly address that question?
Certainly, Judge Cochran. So, and the part of Public Law 280 the defendant is pointing to is in the statute itself, which I have right here. And this is 28 U.S. Code Section 1360. This is the civil half of Public Law 280. And Judge Ross was quoting from Part A earlier, and I believe defendant is referring to Part C, and actually, you know, recited a significant part of Part C from memory during oral argument earlier. But I would point to the
Part C, is that also codified in in the same provision? I mean, I is, in other words, is he citing to the language that any tribal ordinance or custom there to that language?
I believe so, Your Honor. And I think then, you know, I would point to the final half, the second half of that. This is a grant of concurrent jurisdiction or an invitation to state courts to consider and apply tribal law in instances where public law 280 is the source of jurisdiction. And again, I argue that in this matter, public law 280 is not the source of the state court's jurisdiction. The source of the state court's jurisdiction is state law establishing state courts as forums for citizens of Minnesota to bring grievances. So under Part C, it says, any tribal ordinance or custom heretofore or hereafter adopted by any Indian tribe, band, or community in the exercise of any authority which it may possess shall, if not inconsistent with any applicable civil law of the state, be given full force and effect in the determination of civil causes of action pursuant to this section. So in other words, if there were a relevant tribal statute here and public law 280 were the source of jurisdiction, a state court would still have jurisdiction. This does not strip the state court of jurisdiction. It just obligates the state court to, if not inconsistent, consider that tribal law or custom.
And that language, if not inconsistent with any applicable civil law of the state, is critical.
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
And
thank you.
I see my time is winding. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just said thank you.
All right, so just in conclusion, Liz Campbell, a Minnesota citizen, has sued Honor the Earth, a Minnesota nonprofit corporation, for violating the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The state of Minnesota clearly has jurisdiction over this matter, and declining to exercise that jurisdiction would strip Ms. Campbell of her statutory state civil rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did find where I included that citation on page 4 of the initial brief from appellant, where it does make the same paragraph that was commented on. I would argue that you need to look at this in time again, because when you listen to counsel, she makes it sound like this was something stated last year by Congress. This was 1953. So you have to think, when it says not inconsistent with applicable law, that really means we have the right to create a court. It's not inconsistent with state law that tribes set up a court. It's not inconsistent that we set up our jurisdiction. It's not inconsistent that we define subject matters through torts and contract and other things for people to have an action. When you look at the way the United States Supreme Court analyzed Bryan, they talked about private causes of action, and it said that the state court could not use its taxation authority against reservation Indians.
Counsel, though, the Bryan case involved the state as a party. This case involves two private litigants. And I think that's a critical distinction in trying to argue the analysis in Bryan applies here. Or I think that's a critical reason why the Bryan case is not is distinguishable from this case in terms of the reasoning applied there.
Again, Bryan was 1976. It was 1997 when the Minnesota Supreme Court finally understood it didn't have jurisdiction over a lot of different matters involving traffic in state court. When you look at Bryan, what it's saying is the state does not have the authority to use its franchises of sovereign power against the Indians and what we have. And so you have to see that corporation as one of our possessions, and that the state previously in Bryan was attempting to tax us. Now it's using a different state agency with different state laws created by the legislature. These aren't the laws of private citizens.
How is Honor the Earth,
the state of Minnesota, being used by the court? Now, there are court cases in federal court where the tribal members have had to sue the state court for exercising jurisdiction. That's the kind of power I'm talking about now, not the AG, not the county attorney. I'm talking about the state court exercising jurisdiction is contrary to federal law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bebo, I'm going to backtrack again to my poorly worded question before. Does it matter to your subject matter jurisdiction argument whether the conduct being the allegedly unlawful conduct took place on the reservation or off the reservation? If all of the conduct had taken place off the reservation, then is there jurisdiction under the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
If all of the conduct is off reservation, I would say yes. If you look at the conduct that is alleged, there is very little in Minnesota. There's Colorado, there's Canada, you know, there's nothing really in Minnesota. And the district court made the mistake of somehow thinking that Campbell had a house that she was residing in St. Paul, where there's no evidence whatsoever that she had any other residence but at White Earth during those 7 years. So facts have been created to get to the place that we are. If it was looked at from the real point of where was the person living, where was the person working, were they in another jurisdiction that has the right to exercise jurisdiction like North Dakota or like Iowa, it's just that we are an enclave entity within Minnesota, and that's where it gets confusing. If all the conduct was on reservation, I think the Minnesota Court of Minnesota Human Rights said no, no probable cause, no finding. And I think the court here would have found that if Campbell had been candid when filing the complaint and said the reason I'm filing in civil court is because there was no probable cause finding by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And if the Minnesota Department of Human Rights law was criminal, this is a double jeopardy proceeding.
But do we even need to address whether it's criminal or civil regulatory if the action is between two private parties and the state isn't involved?
Your Honor, the state is involved. The state is the deciding party. The state is exercising jurisdiction through the judicial branch.
I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. If the state is not a party.
Okay, if the state is not a party, could you exercise jurisdiction? You are.
My question is, does this court need to address the question of whether the Minnesota Human Rights Act is a civil regulatory law or a criminal law if the state is not a party to the lawsuit? Is that an issue we even need to reach?
I believe so, Your Honor. When you look at the Oregon case, that is a pure fiction of law. The real way that case is set up for civil forfeiture is that the defendant or the person who named it for their bad conduct has to sue their vehicle or whatever has been taken because it's allowed them to drive poorly. Now, that's a pure legal fiction to get around the double jeopardy clause of the state of Minnesota. And that becomes how the civil get around goes. And that's what's going on here. There's an attempt to go around the civil jurisdiction of Indian country by White Earth through the tribal court jurisdiction. This is clearly, as was indicated, every person named in the complaint was an Indian.
Thank you, Mr. Bebo, and thank you, Ms. Hall. Matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.